This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Now, most any modern musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Baby, I'm home.
Who you got today, Jim?
Well, hi there, everybody, and welcome. I'm Jim Irvin, and this is Time Signatures. For only the second time since Time Signatures with Jim Irvin launched, you are about to hear these words. Today's guest is a man that needs no introduction, period. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my great pleasure to welcome the fabulous Thunderbirds founder, a true product of Detroit, Michigan, Kim Wilson, to Time Signatures. Honored to have you, sir. How are you?
I'm happy to be here. I'm great. Well, I'm kind of great. I got a bad back. My back is terrible, but other than that, I'm good.
Now, since it's my job to preserve the history of the blues one story at a time, Kim, I'd like to begin with your earliest memories of music. How did this incredible journey begin for you?
Well, I was a musician when I was 9, and I was a trombone player. It's an interesting story. We were in Detroit. I left Detroit in 59, 60. I was 9 years old. And but when I'm 8 or 9 years old, then we were in Detroit in grade school, and we had mandatory music a couple times a week. So the music teacher came in one day. He had a baritone horn and a trombone. He picked me out of the class and another kid, and he handed me the baritone horn and said, "Play it." So I played it, and I immediately was in the band. I went to trombone after that.
Okay.
But I was immediately in the band, and that's kind of how I was kind of a fine artist at that age as well. You know, I did things like dinosaur murals all the way around the classroom and stuff like that. You know, they kind of commissioned me to do those kind of things. So it was a, you know, I was always interested in the arts. And then I was also interested in athletics, hence the bad back. And I played football. I quit playing music after I moved to California. My dad moved us to California from Detroit in 1960, and he was with GM. And so they stuck me in a class. We had private lessons also, me and my brother. I'll never forget, because my brother did not like the private lessons, and the instructor was very mean to him. But I just decided I wanted to be an athlete. And so I quit playing music at that time, after about a year or so in the school band. And I started playing football and track and whatever else I could, you know, I thought I had an aptitude for. And I didn't really pick up and get an interest in music till my senior year in high school. And I had a bunch of buddies who loved blues, and they would take me from Goleta down to L.A. to the places like the Ash Grove and the Golden Bear and see all these incredible musicians. And I just decided I wanted to pick up a harmonica, and I started doing it, you know. And a month later, I was in a band because I could kind of sing. And a year later, you know, a year after I started, I was playing with people like Eddie Taylor. It was pretty incredible.
Yeah, and the fact that you picked up that harmonica, it seemed like you were a quick study on it from what I read. And you guys ended up opening, your band that you joined were opening for Three Dog Night and Savoy Brown, is that correct?
That's weird, because I had a broken collarbone from being in the football all-star practice, and I got my collarbone broken. So I'm up there with the big strap. It was a crazy kind of transition, you know. And we were playing around town Goleta, Santa Barbara area, pretty much. That's it. There was a jazz club downtown called The Spigot, where Roland Kirk had played, and Cal Jader and people like that. And it was a jazz club. And so they started letting people play blues in there, and it became kind of a speakeasy joint, you know.
Okay.
That's kind of where I got it started, in that place.
Now, Kim, I'd love to hear the story about how you met George Harmonica Smith via your friend John Phillips.
Wow. You've been doing your homework. But yeah, my buddy John.
I try.
John Phillips was a very dear friend of mine. God rest him. He was a wonderful person, and he was an ab diver. He was he dived for abalone and collected rare shells that he would sell. But he was also a harmonica player, and he also had a lot of music that I had never heard before. And when I first met John, he told me he thought I was from South Africa. No idea why. And he would get me on many, many, many stages, right? He'd be playing frat parties out in UCSB, and he'd get me up on the bandstand. He'd see me in the audience. And, you know, so there was this place out in Goleta called The Headband, and all the blues guys played there. I mean, I saw so many people. I saw Big Joe Turner. I saw, you know, Albert Collins, Jimmy Reed, so many different people. And so he's up there. He's opening for George Harmonica Smith. Now, George was, it was just George Smith at that time. It wasn't George Harmonica Smith. It was just George Smith. So he sees me in the audience. Now, it's rare that I don't have a band, even back then. But I didn't have, there was one piece missed, and I said, I'm going to go see my hero. So I'm sitting there, and he does three songs. And then George would get up and he would get down. Well, on the break, he sees me in the audience. He comes up to me and says, hey, listen, man, I want you to play my three songs on the next set. Very generous. And I said, no, I don't know, man. I was kind of chickening out. And he said, no, you're doing it. So I got up there and we're playing along. We play the first two songs. Crowd's going pretty crazy. I'll never forget that. It was a big crowd, you know, for a club. And we go into the third song, get about halfway through it, and George jumps up on stage with me. Now, that, I'm bow-legged, and my knees were knocking, because that guy was a huge influence on me. So so we finished the song. I go to get off the stage, and he grabs me and says, uh-uh. You're staying here. So we did like a whole rest of the set. And, you know, George was a very vaudevillian kind of guy. He would lay on his back, kick up his legs. He was he was a great showman. And he would make me do everything that he was doing, right? It was kind of a mirror image thing. So we get done with the set, and I'm in La La Land. What's happened? You know, I'd probably played with a couple other people. I played with Eddie Taylor before him and maybe one other. And so club owner says, you know, well, by the way, we would do You Don't Love Me. And so it was just on the one, and the band would get down one at a time until it was just George and I. So song ends, set ends, crowd's going crazy, and club owner comes up and says, how about it for George Smith? And I don't know who this guy is. And he handed me a C note, which was a huge amount of money at that time.
Wow.
And so I'm like, wow. And so, and then George comes up to me and says, I want you to finish out the week with me. Because that's the way the gigs were at that time. He played for 3 or 4 days at least. So it was like, wow. I go, really? And he said, yeah, I'm for real, as they told me. I'll never forget it. And so that's what we did. We became very good friends with him, actually. And, I went to see him later at the Headband. He was opening for Jimmy Reed.
Okay.
And he did not like Jimmy Reed. But he called himself Jimmy Reed in some false advertising at times. But he did not like Jimmy Reed. And so that was interesting. That was interesting to see. I mean, he didn't say anything to Jimmy Reed. He was just in the kind of stewing in the dressing room having to open for him. So, you know, he was a character. He was a real character. I mean, and that's the beautiful thing. Not to change the subject, but I mean, people like George, Eddie Taylor, all the great Chicago, Texas blues musicians, you know. The beautiful thing about blues music at that time was everybody had their own style. Everybody had their own personality. Everybody had their own way of doing things. Everybody had their own way of singing, telling a joke. That has kind of gone away, and it's become a lot more generic now. So I'm so happy that I was able to be around at that time and learn from these guys, because I learned from all of them. I learned from watching them more. I didn't ever get a lesson, but I'd learn something. I'd go up and play it on the stage, let's say with George. I go, hey, you hear that? When I played right there, that was third position, huh? How did I do? He goes, you did fine. That's great. And that's it. You know, that was like the lesson. So, you know, it was incredible to be around at that time. I mean, I remember we had a band in Goleta, and it was a pretty good little band. And, I mean, I was just a kid. I mean, I wasn't much. But we played this place called Fergie's, and he had just opened this joint, right?
Yes, sir.
It was on Dawson Street in downtown Goleta. It was barely a town at that time. So I walked in. I said, you need a band. He said, okay. So brought the band in there. We worked for very little money. About 3 months later, I said, you know what? Bring Pee Wee Creighton up here. We'll back him up. Bring up Lowell Fulson. Bring Albert Collins. So I met all these guys. Bring Luther Tucker. Bring High Tide Harris. Oh, you probably never heard of him. But, you know, so I met all these people. Margie Evans. I mean, it was a lot of the people that were living in L.A. at that time. Of course, George and Lowell were both Texans. And so was Albert. So it wasn't really harmonica music, but they liked me anyway. And that was very gratifying as well. And I met so many people in my first 3 years of playing that, you know, for some reason they loved me. And I think they loved me because they knew I would take a bullet for them, you know. I knew they loved me because I loved the music so much, and I was just, you know, chomping at the bit just to get myself going in it, you know. So I realized early on that, and I know I'm doing all the talking here, but I realized early,
you're fired out,
I wasn't going to be able to live by playing solos off records. I had to improvise myself. So I remember walking down the street one day, kind of scat singing and whistling and singing, thinking to myself, that's pretty good. I wish I could do that on the harmonica. So what I did was I bought a boom box. I sang and hummed and whistled into the boom box, and I would copy that on the harmonica. And that's how I learned how to improvise.
Wow. You know, you were talking about being fortunate to come up in that era. And I have to agree with you, because I think if there was any time that I would consider perfect to come up, that would have been it. But one of the things that caught my attention when I was reading about your progress and learning from the masters is the deep, never-ending respect that you have always expressed for these older artists. And that's never wavered with you, has it?
No, and they're not just older artists. They're the originators.
Yes, sir.
And that's the whole thing. They're the originators of this music. And to be treated like one of them at an early age, I mean, it was a mind blower. I mean, you just couldn't even believe that these guys were even talking to you. You know, I was a pretty aggressive guy. I mean, I was kind of a pest, but then people kept asking for me, and it became less of a pest and hot commodity.
Well, it's amazing to me as I've heard several times. This is so reminiscent of stories that I've heard about the younger white blues students in Chicago, Butterfield, Bloomfield, Corky Siegel, and then, of course, William Clark from out west, who also shared a relationship with Harmonica Smith and so many others. But I think the common thread between all of you guys is your deep-seated respect and appreciation for those musicians, and they recognize that. And I think that's why you were accepted into that family. Do you agree?
Yes.
Okay.
All the way.
So, you ended up, go ahead, I'm sorry.
You go ahead.
I was just going to move to another area, because you relocated from Santa Barbara to Minnesota for a little bit, and I was just wondering what caused that move.
Trying to find my way. You know, I just, things weren't popping in California, and
okay.
I said, okay, I'm leaving. I'm going to go find where I can work. Play, you know. So I did that, and that was an interesting time. You know, met a whole new set of people. You met people like Boogie Woogie Red, Eddie Burns. I actually played with Fenton Robinson at that time. Who else? A couple other people, and people that I'd already known were coming through town and playing and seeing me there and going, what the hell are you doing here? You know, Albert Collins was one of those. Albert Collins was a really wonderful person. And, you know, he was, you know, all of them. I never met a bad one. I never met a bad originator, ever.
How cool is that?
They were always, they all welcomed me with open arms. A wonderful... And still is a wonderful ride.
Kim, your connection to Jimmy Vaughn was a real page-turner for me, because that really is where all of this fun began for you both. Slow as it was at first, but I would love to have you share the story of your transportation down to Texas, if you will.
Well, I had called him, and... what happened was, Lowell Fulson had a guy named Mark Pollock playing second guitar with him.
Okay.
In Goleta. And Mark Pollock started talking to me about Austin. So, you know, I'm going like, well, I didn't really want to leave. I didn't want to take a chance, blah, blah, blah. And finally, he had this girlfriend named Shirley Dimmick, and she offered me a position in her new business, which was... publishing company, a club, you know, it was, and I was going to be an advisor. Now, in the meantime, before that happened, actually, in the chain of events was I had met these guys. See, when I was in Minnesota, Willie Dixon came into town with his All-Stars. Now, Charlie, can't remember his last name now. He was the proprietor over there at the Caboose Bar in Minnesota.
Okay.
And he was playing, he wanted to play this demo tape that I had of doing some Sonny Boy Williamson stuff and things like that for Dixon. Well, Dixon blew his mind. And Dixon immediately wanted to be my manager, and he was. It was crazy. Wow. And Dixon really didn't have time for me. So that was short-lived. But he threw me on to Jimmy Reed's manager, Bill Dyson, who hooked me up with these guys named Phil and Leonard in Seattle. They had the fifth largest African-American-owned business in the country and they wanted to start a blues label. Then Bill Dyson died, but I was hooked up with these guys. They came to town, and we did a single. This is a long time ago, man. This is like 1973. Yeah. And so we they got me. $50 in a new suit, and they got me. So I'm okay, we did this single, ADA Records. That was the name of it. And they set up this big showcase at Six Stadium in Seattle. And now, I had already been down to Austin by this time. And I had met Jimmy, but I didn't really feel like going back down there, you know. That's where I am right now, actually. So I said, okay, well, you know. So I get a call from Vaughn. I'm coming up there. Okay, you can sit in with them. I didn't even know the guy, you know. You can sit in with the band. I'm playing for three nights in one place. You can sit in with the band. So he comes, sits in. We get stinking drunk, and he starts talking about, you know, how cool it is down in Austin and everything. So I say, okay, I'll come down one more time and check it out. So I went to Seattle to play this big show, which was Howlin' Wolf, John Lee Hooker.
Man.
Albert Collins was on the show. Margie Evans was on the show. And then I told the band I was going down to see my girlfriend in San Francisco, and I went to Austin. And so I went down there, checked it out. I love the weather, especially compared to Minnesota at that time. So, you know, I went down. I said, okay. Came back up to Minnesota, gave them a month's notice, and I left with two or three of those guys in a car, with all my records, my clothes, and one amp, and that's all I had. And I went down to Texas and didn't do anything for about a year. It was very discouraging. So, but, you know, the beginnings of that, if it wasn't for Antones, I mean, we would have had nothing. And I think that, unbeknownst to a lot of people, the beginnings of this band, and they were pretty influential. You know, the first four records we did, we didn't even have a record deal until 78 or 9.
Wow.
We've been together about 4 or 5 years by that time.
Sure.
And Denny Bruce came down, wanted to manage us, and he was producing Leo Kottke. He was Leo Kottke's manager. So we signed a deal with him, you know, blindfolded. And we just started recording. I mean, I know the first record we did, we probably recorded 40 songs in 2.5 days. We just recorded everything we knew.
Sure.
And that ended up being the Girls Go Wild record. Then we used some of the stuff that we hadn't used, we used on the next record. And we had met Jake Riviera from the manager of Rockpile. And in 81 or 80, we went down to and over to England, and we met him, and he signed us up for a tour with that band for about 30 shows. I didn't even know there were that many shows. It was just
one EP.
So that's where I met those guys. So Nick Lowe says he wants to produce our next record, and that's where T-Bird Rhythm came in. And we did that with an official producer. And that's a good record. It's a very good record.
Yes.
So that's how I met all those guys. It's kind of a whirlwind, you know, it all happened kind of all at once. We had moved from Tacoma then to Chrysalis, right? Which is where I believe T-Bird Rhythm went.
Okay.
And then there was another one after that, or that might have been the last one. And then they dropped us. So we were labelless and wondering, once again, here I am wondering, what am I going to do? You know, what am I going to do with my life? I want to play music, but it's not looking very good. So we call up Dave Edmonds. I don't know, I can't remember exactly how that happened, but he was another Rock Pile connection. And so Edmonds was pretty hot at that time because he had done the Stray Cats and they had a pretty big record with him.
Sure.
So he said, okay, let's do it. So we all fly over there to Great Britain, London, get a flat for a month, two flats, and we start recording. And that ended up being the Tough Enough record. Now, there was a label that we were doing that for that immediately went bankrupt, okay? Now, here we are. We're sitting with these masters in our hands and nobody to put them out. And we probably shopped that for a year, maybe longer. And finally, this fellow named Tony Martell, I don't know if you know who that is. He's got the Martell Foundation. He's probably not alive anymore. But okay. He's a part of the Columbia CBS Epic family. He calls us into his office in New York, and he said, boys, I think I can sell this. Okay. Sign on the dotted line. So another album you don't get paid for. But what he did was create his own label. And he says, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to create this label, and you're going to be able to use everybody in CBS, Epic, Columbia. You can use all the PR people, which we did. And there was no Nashville at that time. It was just LA and New York. And that was the difference between those two was incredible.
Sure.
But we were in business, you know. And it was interesting to watch that album climb the way it did. I mean, it was... in the meantime, yeah.
And it seems like your life just was one serendipitous step after another. And
yeah.
So I need to turn the page here because it seems like through the years, you've made some really big name friends and they've always seemed to steer you on the right path along the way. Among those, Muddy Waters. How did that relationship come together? And I would love to hear about the call to have you come out east.
Well, I met Muddy Waters at Antone's and I met a lot of people. He was playing for like five nights, right? So we go walking in the club to do our little whatever it was, sound check, whatever it was. And we walk by the band, they're just going like, yeah, all right, you know. And so we get there that night for the show, and Antone's had a dressing room where there was a curtain and like a balcony and just a curtain separating it from the stage below. So we would always start out with a harmonica instrumental. As soon as we did that, those curtains just went, and there's Muddy with his head at half the curtain going, you know, wow, kind of wide-eyed. And then all I can tell you is, without getting into too much detail, that was the beginning of a beautiful friendship between myself and Muddy Waters. And, you know, we had some incredible moments, just me and him, that were, you know, it's, like I say, you live, every time you meet somebody like that, you're walking on cloud nine.
Yes, sir.
Every time, every single time, you know, and so, I mean, Muddy Waters was the guy that I wanted to impress because all the great harmonica players had been through his band. So it was a very special thing to me when he said all those wonderful things about me. And I was, you know, all I wanted to do since then was live up to it, you know?
Well, and a lot like Bob Margolin, for example, you guys seem like you're cut from the same cloth. You're just down-to-earth people, and like you said, the originators, you never met a bad one.
No.
Another big connection in the genre for you was none other than Jimmy Rogers. Now, last evening as I was finalizing my prep for this interview, I was looking for some of your music, and I stumbled upon Jimmy Reed's Ludella album. You guys were just flat out having a blast, weren't you?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we had been, that's a funny story with that record, because we had been in the studio and we recorded a few, not enough. And I played many, many shows with Jimmy Rogers in that club. And so I was driving in California. I'll never forget, it was raining, which is rare there. And I was driving to my folks' house down in San Diego, listening to all these cassettes of the anniversary, of the Anton's anniversary that had just happened. Now, I had just gotten sober. So that was like 1988.
Okay.
And so when I listen, I'm listening, I'm not like, okay. And then there's one thing, this one tape, and it was like, what? That's pretty good. Wow. I kept listening, and I'm like, man. And so we ended up using filling in with the live stuff to the studio stuff, and that became Ludella.
Wow.
That was Jimmy Rogers. He was really proud of that record, too. He's very proud of it.
That's an album.
That's a way that you pay back, okay? Producing a record like that and playing on it, that's one way to pay back.
Well, and then there was one of my all-time favorites, an album that you recorded live at the Rhythm Room in Phoenix, a venue owned by a good friend of mine, Bob Corritore. What do you remember about that evening as you were recording those tracks? Because, again, it sounded like you were just having a good time.
That was it. I mean, there was actually 2 or 3 days of that in a row. And so that's what we were doing. I was just calling them off. We were playing them. There's a whole bunch of that stuff still there, you know. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff. If we wanted to release it, we could. But you know, we had Richard and Lara Burry, God bless them, and because they were monsters, and they were real blues guys. They were real blues people. And then I had Billy Flynn, who I played with last night here at Anton's, and Rusty Zinn, and that was the band, and myself. And it was a great time. And my wife was in the audience with her dad. You can hear her screaming. Now, I had no idea I was going to marry this woman for about 20 years. So, but, you know, it was, every time I listen to that record now, and some of the outtakes, I was listening to an outtake of a Sonny Boy Williamson song yesterday.
Oh.
And it was like, wow, that's pretty good. And then there's my wife in the back. She was great. Now, she is great.
That's wonderful. Now, one other item that I happened upon as I was preparing for this chat was your ties to a mutual friend in the person of Detroit's Queen of the Blues, Thornetta Davis. Now, I don't mind telling you, I'm always learning, okay? I'm always learning. I don't know everything. It seems like every time I turn a corner, I'm learning something new. And I learned that you played harp on her Honest Woman album. The song was I Sang the Blues. And by the way, I wanted to tell you, Thornetta sends her best and wanted me to let you know that she said hello. But
bless her.
How did this collaboration come together, man?
She just called me.
Oh,
I used to go see her when I lived in Detroit for a while. I was born in Detroit.
Yes.
Went back and lived there in Oxford, actually. So I remember going to see her. And it's a mind-blowing voice.
Oh, man.
That's a voice that, you know, that's a voice. So, you know, we kind of became friends. Next thing I know, it was a while since I met her, But she called me up to play on her CD and was happy to do it. And I love Thornetta. I wish her only the best.
Yes, indeed. Kim, for 52 years, you have remained as one of the constant, the only constant member of the Fabulous Thunderbirds, last man standing, so to speak. And you've been quoted as saying that you love what you do and you plan to keep on playing for the rest of your life. Now, that quote was from 2 years ago. You still got that fire?
Of course. I love it more than I ever have. I've got a bad back right now, so I've had to sit down on a stage a couple times. But, you know, that's going to go away, and I'll be back to my usual trotting around self on the bandstand. But, yeah, I love playing. It's something you never retire from, especially blues.
Yes.
You see these big rock people, you know, okay, I'm going to go on tour every 2 years. You know, we'll rehearse for a month. I'm going, no, that's not me. I'm on the road all the time because I like doing it. And the band that I have is incredible, absolutely incredible. And it's getting better all the time because there's all kinds of tweaks. And even though it's old people, we can learn. We can learn. We can learn from our experience. And I think that, I've got a guy named Rudy, a pet shower, we call him Rudy Albin. He played with brother Jack McDuff for 6 years. And last night we had Billy Flynn. Of course, we know how great he is.
All Billy.
Bob Welsh, the keyboards. Yeah, Billy's unbelievable. And Bob Welsh on the keyboards and a guitar. And then Johnny Moeller comes in. So, and then I've got a kid named Steve Christie. He's the young one. He's like in his 30s. Great, great bass player. And he plays upright as well. So it's, I think, you know, we're really just starting to latch on to what we are. I think that we, the whole contemporary thing, that's just fleeting. You know what I mean? I mean, now we've become a real blues band. And we always were. We were just attempting to play contemporary music. Because we had luck with it before, you know?
Yes, sir.
Which was really a challenge, saying, oh, you're never going to go anywhere with that, blah, blah, blah. Oh, really? Okay, so we had tough enough. And that was... You know, we had another record or two after that, all the way to Powerful Stuff. Powerful Stuff was a pretty big record. But now we're very much in control of our own destiny. And I think that you're able to move people like you want to move them. You're able to use dynamics. You're able to use everything that is musical. And that just makes me feel nothing but great. So I'm really, really happy. I'm way at the top of my game. I mean, I'm a better singer than I ever was, depending on the night. But, of course, I'm a better harmonica player than I ever was because you're always learning that.
Yeah.
So I think that, I got quite a few years left in me.
From your lips to God's ears, I certainly hope so. As you look forward to the next generation of the blues that's coming up, Kim, are you encouraged by those that you are seeing come to the fore, musically speaking?
A couple.
Okay.
Jontavious Willis.
Yep.
This kid, Mac McDonald.
Yes. Oh, man. Just got to see him play with John Namath a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. Young Rel.
Yes, sir.
Another one. You know him? He's just a kid. They're all kids. And, I think they have potential. And we'll see how they do in the end, but, have potential. I think Jontavious has really got his finger on what he wants to do. And I think he's really good at it. I think that Mac is... we were just talking about this today. Well, it's really all about trying to bring more young African-American people into the music.
Yes, sir.
It's not going to be easy, okay? They don't want to hear it. So, I think that there's ways to trick everybody in humanity by just moving them. Doesn't matter if you're black, white, polka dot, wherever you are. You move everybody. You move them. And you make sure that they want to come back and hear you again. And no matter what you're doing, if you're playing blues, you're playing rock and roll, you know, if you're playing hip hop, you know, the blues is, and real blues, it's a challenge because people want to hear wailing ass guitar that you can get about as far away from the blues as, it's all blues, right? But they can make it pretty far away from blues, you know what I mean? And so there's a lot of screeching going on out there. Hey, that's okay. Listen, you have to have brass balls to get up on a bandstand and play in front of people. I don't care what you do.
Yeah,
so God bless them. God bless them. You know, I can't, it's hard to say bad about anybody, to be honest with you, because they're making a stab at it, however they want to do it. You know, well, okay, might not be my cup of tea, but there's ways to do it. Myself, I have a little recognition, so I can kind of do it like I want to, you know. And these kids, they watched me, and people like me, and okay, they can do that, I can do it, and good. If that's how I'm influencing them, good. I think that they need to just have a good time. You know what I mean? Like we're doing right now.
Yes.
Just have fun. Just have fun with it. You know, when you start making it a living, that's when you put the pressure on yourself. I know all about that. And, you know, I think if you do it for fun first and foremost, and you don't get stuck in a place where you're doing it the same way every time because you made a lot of money that way, that's a mistake. It's not a mistake maybe for the audience because they don't know, but it's a mistake for you because you know. And like, there's some songs, I was just trying to figure out a way to play a rock and roll song as a shuffle, one that we recorded a long time ago. It actually is pretty good. The lyrics are really good in this song. And so I'm going to tell you what it is, but I think it could be a great blues shuffle. So, yeah, you know, just have a good time. Have a good time. If you're having fun, you're going to learn because you want to learn. You don't want to put the thing down because you're just disgusted with the business. And the business is a disgusting thing. You know, people don't even realize what you go through when you're with a major label. It's insane, okay? And it's a lot of power wielding. And you just fall into it and say, oh, yes, sir, okay. I'm gonna, you know, I'll never forget when Tony Martell, we were leaving, we had a big hit with Tough Enough, and we're getting into the car. And Tony opens the door, whispers in my ear, okay, now, give me another one, just like the last one. And I went, I don't know what I said, but I said to myself, I don't do that. That's not what I do. And so, you know, it's... You just have a good time. Now more than ever, you are in control of your own destiny. Okay, I'm not saying there's a huge amount of money to be made out there for a lot of people. Probably not.
Right.
But you know what? You're in control of your own destiny. You can do what you want to do. If, you know, you want a day job, okay, do a day job, play on the weekends. You know, however it works for you, as long as you can have a good time doing it and not put pressure on yourself to feed the family playing music. Because that's difficult. That's very difficult.
Yes, sir. Kim, where can we send people to learn more about you, the band, your music, maybe to buy some music from you, or get you booked for a gig in their area?
Well, you can go to fabulousthunderbirds.com and you can find out what we're doing. Getting booked, I got a guy named Todd in L.A. What the hell is the name of that company? Anyway, Oops, I turned it off. I'll have to tell you about it later. You can find everything actually on the website. Okay.
Okay.
And I got a great manager. This guy's an incredible guy. He's like somebody I went to school with. First time I've ever had a manager like that. His name is Glenn Parrish. He used to manage Stevie Nicks, and he's still dear friends with her. And this guy's a very, very empathetic and caring individual. He's not a blues guy, but he has such an ear that he knows when you're moving him. And that, you can't ask for more than that, you know? And he's a wonderful person. So it's really great that I've had him for like 15 years now, believe it or not. Seemed like just yesterday, but he's been really great for me. And he's a very connected guy. So he, we're able to get on a couple things that I might not be able to get onto usually without someone like him. So yeah, he's a wonderful person.
Well, Kim Wilson, I have to tell you, I'm overwhelmed. I appreciate you taking time for me today on Time Signatures. I wish you all the best, and I truly hope to get an opportunity to come and see you play sometime. If you do, I'll be happy to bring my camera. I'm also a professional photographer, and I wouldn't charge you anything for the photos, but I'd love to shoot for you sometime if I get a chance. How's that sound?
That's great. If you see it, look at the website. There's quite a few shows. You're going to see a lot of shows on there. So look at the website. I'll be happy to see you.
And that wraps up this edition of Time Signatures. Once again, my thanks to our guest, Kim Wilson. But also to you. I'm sorry? Thank you, sir. Anyway, as I said, Jim Irvin reminding you, keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues one story at a time is my mission. Hey, that's live broadcasting there for you. All right. Until next time, so long, my friends.
You've been listening to Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Now, for more information about CABS, visit capitalareablues.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham. You can find this episode and past episodes of Time Signatures at lccconnect.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.
Baby, I'm home.
Ooh, shuggy ducky.